The White House and President Trump are attempting to stonewall House Democrats in their impeachment inquiry. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for October 14th, a look at how Congress might respond to the Trump administration's aggressive impeachment strategy.
Democrats are on a crusade to destroy our democracy. That's what's happening.
Also on the show, a shooting outside a Jewish synagogue in Germany serves as an alarming reminder that anti-Semitic assaults are also on the rise in the United States.
Security has become a concern that was never a concern. The very notion that a religious institution would have to think about having a guard at the door, this to me is anathema.
And Sesame Street is starting to teach its viewers about substance abuse among adults. We'll learn more about how to talk to kids about addiction.
It's really helping children get in touch with their emotions that they're experiencing because of what's going on in their world, and then helping them deal with those emotions.
That's all coming up, but first, impeachment. The impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump continues for a fourth week in Washington. And so far, the White House has decided not to play ball. Last Tuesday, White House counsel Pat Cipollone submitted a letter to the House of Representatives calling the impeachment inquiry unconstitutional and saying that the administration would not participate. The New York Times called the White House's position one of the, quote, most extraordinary assertions of executive authority in modern times. At campaign rallies in Minnesota and Louisiana last week, 2020 presidential candidate Trump took his usual shots at his political opponents and had this to say about the inquiry.
The radical Democrats' policies are crazy, their politicians are corrupt, their candidates are terrible, and they know they can't win on election day, so they're pursuing an illegal, invalid, and unconstitutional bullshit impeachment.
Despite the president's feelings about the inquiry, a federal district court in Washington, D.C. dealt him another blow when they upheld a subpoena from the House Committee on Oversight and Reform seeking his financial records. And finally, Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's personal lawyer, may be under investigation by federal prosecutors in Manhattan for his dealings in Ukraine. With us today is Michael Scheer, a White House correspondent for The New York Times. Michael, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, happy to do it, always.
We also have Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. Anita, thank you for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
And Keith Whittington is a professor of politics at Princeton University. Keith, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with you, Keith. How unprecedented is it for the White House to send a letter saying they will not be coordinating with the House on their impeachment inquiry?
It's pretty extraordinary. On the one hand, you wouldn't expect the White House to be totally enthusiastic about helping out the impeachment process, and so you expect them to be a little resistant. But the tone of that letter, the kind of arguments it stakes out, are really very extreme, and the efforts that the White House engages in to try to dictate to the House how exactly an impeachment inquiry ought to proceed are really far out of bounds of what the White House ought to expect is within its own prerogatives and really interferes with how the House runs its own business.
Anita, haven't we seen this before? I mean, when Attorney General William Barr was held in contempt for defying congressional subpoenas, remind us again what happened then.
Yeah, I actually wasn't really that surprised by the letter. So remember, when the Democrats took control of the House in January, we have seen now months and months of them asking for things, subpoena documents, asking people to testify. And the White House has said no repeatedly for all different kinds of people and all different kinds of documents. So it wasn't that surprising, particularly because of that. And also because the letter, though an 8-page letter from a lawyer, sounded a lot like President Trump's tweets, a lot like what he says on a regular basis about how he's not going to cooperate. And it didn't quite say witch hunt, but it was very much the same tone. And so seeing it in paper was a little bit jarring, but the message has been the same message since January.
And Michael, this isn't, as we've said, the first time this administration has refused to cooperate with similar demands. State Department Secretary Mike Pompeo sent a letter earlier this month to Congress, also refusing to comply. Is there anything that makes this letter from the White House different from any of these incidents that we've just laid out?
Well, I mean, I think the things that we've already talked about here, the scope really was the thing that made it different. Past White Houses have always asserted their prerogative to keep certain conversations between the president and his advisors or certain documents private, and they do that on the grounds of executive privilege by saying that that is a function that is solely reserved to the executive branch and that without privacy, the president couldn't do his or her job. The problem with the letter that Pat Cipollone sent was that it essentially asserted that our Article 1 of the Constitution, which gives the power of impeachment process to Congress, essentially was invalid. I mean, the letter essentially argues that Congress had no right to even conduct an investigation and to demand any of this information, which I think most people viewed more as a political statement and a political argument than a legal one. And I think that's why most legal experts that look at it think that while there is a role for the administration to argue that that there are some things that have to be kept private, that it was really went way further than previous White Houses have gone.
And to that point, Michael, I mean, now that this letter is sort of a line drawn in the sand, how do you think the House is going to proceed here?
Well, they've already telegraphed what they at least expect to do, which is to say the previous Congresses have tried to litigate these questions, right? They've taken administrations to court. This Congress obviously has taken the Trump administration to court and said, no, you courts, please tell the administration they have to comply. The problem with that process is that it can take a long time. You get one court to agree, then you have to, the administration appeals, and ultimately it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. So what the Congress has said now is, we're going to take a different approach. By and large, when the administration refuses to comply, we are simply going to consider that to be obstruction of the impeachment inquiry, and we're going to add that to the list of charges from which we can create a set of impeachment criteria and then move on. And that will deprive them potentially of some of the information that these documents and witnesses could provide. But I think they believe that that's worth it in order to keep the process moving quickly.
Keith, we hear the term constitutional crisis, at least under this administration, being batted about a lot. And I want to maybe stay away from that and ask you directly, is there anything in the Constitution that will prepare us for what we're seeing right now with the Trump administration's impeachment strategy?
Well, I think we're seeing an administration that's really trying to lay the groundwork for the Senate trial after an impeachment has already occurred in the House, and to some degree for the presidential campaign. The president seems to be conceding that the House is going to impeach him. There's still questions about what all the articles of impeachment are going to look like, but the president's strategy at this point seems to be to focus further down the road, try to make this into a political case, abandon the effort of trying to persuade the House not to actually pursue an impeachment. And then we'll see how well that strategy works out in the Senate and on the campaign trail. It's a particularly aggressive strategy. It offers very little for the Republicans in the Senate to grab hold of, because the extent to which the White House simply wants to denounce the House's impeachment inquiry as invalid, unconstitutional, illegitimate, I think that's an approach that the Senate Republicans, for example, should be fairly reluctant to want to grab hold of. Instead, they would want to emphasize maybe the president has done some things, but they're not really that bad, and as a consequence, don't justify impeachment removal. Maybe there's some disputes about the underlying facts. But to claim that the House's efforts are simply illegitimate is an extreme claim that the Republicans in Congress ought to resist.
Michael, we've talked a lot about President Trump's rhetoric on this show, and I want to ask you, you've been covering Trump and his presidency since the beginning. Have you seen a change when it comes to his rhetoric, particularly at the rallies that he's been having?
Sure. I mean, it's hard to describe the early Trump rhetoric as somehow mild or not very intense. But even given that, I think we have seen a ramp up both in intensity and in frequency, both at the rallies where the speeches are going longer, they're more intense, he's using more fiery language, more aggressive language, and of course through his Twitter feed as well. He's tweeting significantly more in the last few months than he ever tweeted before, just in terms of the raw numbers. And the numbers of attacks are going up significantly. I mean, the personal directed attacks that increasingly are being directed at members of Congress, especially Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff, who is the Intelligence Committee chairman who's leading the impeachment inquiry. And I think none of that is an accident. I think all of that is designed, as we've sort of talked about already here, to invalidate the investigation. He is running the same playbook that he ran with the Mueller inquiry, which is to say, to try to invalidate the people and the information that is being arrayed against him, with the hopes that by the time we get to the end, people will see it as an invalid inquiry. And I think that's part of the timing situation on the Hill, where the lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers, are hoping to do this quickly to give him less time to complete that mission.
Anita, based off of what Michael was just saying, and in terms of whether or not the president's rhetoric has become more aggressive, particularly under this impeachment inquiry, you know, he mentioned that the president obviously is using a very similar playbook here. At the same time, polls are showing and have been showing for at least the past week that there's growing support for this inquiry among many Americans. Do you think, Anita, that there will be implications for Trump's aggressive rhetoric here on this, whether it's on his supporters? Will it just start to not matter much to people anymore?
I've talked to a lot of people that are, you know, sort of prominent Republicans that are counseling him that talking about Ukraine and what's going on with that investigation is just not the same as Russia. These are a lot of people that support the president. They want him to win, but they are saying, look, when the Russia investigation was going on, we felt okay because we knew there was no there, right? There were different things that happened, but they felt confident that he himself, the president, hadn't done anything. But with Ukraine, not only has he made the call to the Ukraine president, he has admitted he made the call. He released, a partial transcript or a rough transcript, and we have all this other information. So there was something that happened. The president claims he didn't do anything wrong. Other people say that it was something wrong. So it just feels like it's very different. In terms of the rhetoric, I feel like last week at these two rallies that you mentioned were almost as sort of the launch of the reelection campaign. Now, I know he launched several months ago at a different rally, but it felt really different to me. This feels like what we're going to see for the next 13 months. And I was talking to Trump supporters or seeing, you know, what they had said about the rallies, and they loved it. They loved that language. You know, I'd add one thing to what Mike said, which is there were more curse words than I remember. He was, you know, swearing, and they loved every bit of it. These are rank and file supporters. These are people that go to the rallies. These are not people in Washington per se. So, you know, those people are going to love this. They are going to continue to be with him, I think. It's people that he's trying to get in swing districts. Remember he was in Minneapolis last week. That's a Democratic area, but he wants to win that state. He was very close. So it's people that are maybe on the fence. They're not going to like that, and that might turn them off. So it can help him in one way, but it hurt him in another.
Keith, are there any moments in U.S. political history that you find useful to think about right now, similar battles between a president and Congress?
Well, this clearly, I think, echoes the battles between the Reconstruction Congress and Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson, of course, was the first president to be impeached, and he found himself at odds with the Reconstruction Congress throughout his presidency. He had been vice president during the second term of Abraham Lincoln. When Lincoln was assassinated, Andrew Johnson rose to the presidency. Many thought he was certainly out of step with the Republican Party. Some saw him as illegitimate, and he tended to view the Congress as illegitimate. And so a lot of the Trump's rhetoric now, his stonewalling, his harsh political attacks on Congress, really do feel very reminiscent to the kinds of things that Andrew Johnson also tended to do to Congress, and ultimately led into his impeachment.
Bringing it back up to today, Michael, the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, is under potential investigation by Manhattan prosecutors. What do we know about that so far?
Well, look, the Rudy is being looked into because of allegations that he was involved in efforts to bring U.S. Bring cash with Ukraine to the U.S. in a kind of scheme with two associates of his who he had who had connected him to a U.S. congressman that's not named in the indictment but is thought to be Pete Sessions. And all of that is not good for President Trump because it lends a sort of air of criminality to what has up to this point been largely questions of political impropriety. And, you know, there is no indication that President Trump necessarily was involved in some of that, but it doesn't help for the president's political fortunes as members of Congress dig into it all.
Anita, how are people within the Trump administration, at least behind closed doors, reacting to the entire situation? Are they, and specifically, are they supportive of Giuliani?
No, there are a lot of people that think the president should sideline him, just not have him as an attorney or at least get him off the air. He's done a lot of media interviews, as you know, that end up sort of he's contradicting himself. He doesn't quite make sense, or he gets angry, belligerent at the host or someone he's on with. So there are a lot of people saying you need to move on from him and find someone else. And, you know, the president was convinced to find someone else in former Congressman Trey Gowdy of South Carolina. But, you know, like so many things in this administration, they didn't quite vet everything and didn't quite figure everything out before it was announced. And it turns out Trey Gowdy, by lobbying rules, is not allowed to communicate with Congress to try to influence them. So while he could serve on his team, he can't really do the thing he's there for. So there's been a lot in the administration, in the White House in particular, where they don't really know who's in charge of this. Who's going to respond on impeachment? Is it this, you know, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner? Is it his acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney? And what is that response? So what we've really seen over these last 3 or 4 weeks is just the president out there himself pushing back his own response, right? He's talking to reporters and tweeting multiple times a day. And then we have this letter that his, you know, the counsel, White House counsel's office put together that really reflects what he's been saying and thinking. So, you know, there are people that feel that he needs more staff and he needs a dedicated staff just to respond to this.
Michael, you've been covering this since the beginning here, and you've covered past presidents. I mean, how does that stand out to you in terms of the lack of, you know, there hasn't been a White House press briefing in months. You know, we haven't seen the president's usual folks coming out and talking to reporters. How do you assess this approach by the president, particularly under this impeachment inquiry?
Well, I mean, look, part of the problem for the president is that he doesn't have a kind of disciplined message strategy. He never has, obviously, but previous presidents, one of the things that previous presidents have always tried to do is to put in place a kind of distance between the press and the president himself, so that when times get tough, you don't put the president himself in the position of having to respond directly and personally to these kinds of allegations. That's what the press secretary has always been for. That's what associates of the president who you designate carefully have always been for. And the president, this president, President Trump, has always rejected that. But now he finds himself in a place where, rather than having a kind of well-oiled, disciplined message strategy and message machine with people who know how to kind of, you know, fight these battles. Instead, he's both doing it himself through Twitter and on the South Lawn of the White House right before he gets on a helicopter, or he's latched on to people like Rudy, who, as Anita says, just aren't the kind of disciplined message people that you would expect. And that's causing headaches not only for President Trump, but for his lawyers who are trying to figure out how do we craft a strategy against the impeachment inquiry? And that's going to be more difficult because of the way he's designed his messaging.
Michael Shear is White House correspondent for The New York Times. Anita Kumar is White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. And Keith Whittington is a professor of politics at Princeton University. Michael, Anita, and Keith, thanks to you all for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jewish people throughout the world observed Yom Kippur last Wednesday, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar. And what should have been a somber day of prayer turned into a stern reminder that anti-Semitism is still thriving. On Wednesday, two bystanders were shot and killed after a gunman failed to enter a synagogue in Germany in the middle of a Yom Kippur service. This latest attack comes nearly a year after 11 people were killed in an anti-Semitic attack at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. According to the Anti-Defamation League, the number of anti-Semitic assaults in the United States doubled in 2018, and those numbers have continued to increase this year. And these national numbers are consistent with what Massachusetts is seeing on a state level. Last year, there were 35 reported incidents of anti-Semitism, and there have already been 60 incidents reported so far this year. Here to talk about the increase in anti-Semitism and how Massachusetts is dealing with it on a state level is Paul Singer, an investigations editor at WGBH and the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, and Rabbi Keith Stern from Temple Beth Avoda in Newton, Massachusetts. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rabbi, let's start with you. Before we look at anti-Semitism here in the United States, your father was a Holocaust survivor from Germany. When you saw the attack or heard about the attack last Wednesday, what were your immediate thoughts?
I was absolutely horrified, and I shouldn't have been surprised given the rising anti-Semitism of Europe and its horrors, but, you know, it becomes deeply personal as well, not simply as a Jew. That's already traumatic enough, but that it connects in Germany, there's just something about it that was particularly painful and made me feel a kind of vulnerability that I did not imagine I would be feeling at this stage of my life in our country.
And of course, as we mentioned, Wednesday was Yom Kippur. What did that mean for the Jewish community to have had that attack happen on that day?
Well, I think in general, my guess would be that the majority of rabbis spoke about anti-Semitism as one of their primary sermons. And the notion that this then would occur underscored the need for the American Jewish community to come to a new and clearer understanding of what anti-Semitism is and its complexities, and to really begin to discuss what are we going to do about it.
Paul, when we look at the rise of anti-Semitism in the last few years here in the United States, what is driving that in general?
You know, it's hard to know what the underlying cause is. It is clear there has been this trend where you see an explosion of what I would consider overt anti-Semitic activity. I mean, I'm not sure I can tell you that people are more anti-Semitic than they were 4 years ago. What I can tell you is that, you know, in 2017, the Anti-Defamation League saw 425 incidents of anti-Semitic literature, white supremacist literature, and in 2019 so far, they've seen 1,790. Right? So it's what about a tripling, almost a quadrupling? So is it that people are more angry at the Jews? I doubt it. I think what's happening is that people are moving up the ladder, that they might have been able to express these things to a few friends 5 years ago. They might have been able to go online a couple of years ago and share their hatred with other like-minded communities. And now they see people speaking in about it and doing it in public and going online and videotaping themselves, posting a neo-Nazi or anti-Jewish poster on the door of a synagogue. And so they go to try to do it too. And frankly, the national dialogue has allowed them to say, oh, this is an okay thing to do and to say in public. It's no longer something you keep to yourselves.
And Paul, let's drill down into what's happening in Massachusetts. What are some examples of anti-Semitism that you've seen, given that reports of incidents of anti-Semitism have nearly doubled in the state?
There was a case recently where a historic building in a town here called Hull, some teenagers spray-painted swastikas all over it and Hitler 2020. And then going further up the ladder, more concerning, there have been three attempted arsons at Chabad houses. They're the sort of Orthodox Jewish centers in communities near here. Fortunately, nobody was injured in these attacks. But again, we're moving up the ladder. We're no longer talking about things, no longer thinking about things, no longer putting out a flyer or putting up a poster. Now we're setting fire to buildings. And you begin to ask the question, at what point does the gunfire begin?
Has there been a response from the government or municipal governments about these attacks so far, Paul?
There's been a lot. I mean, the local police in several of these cases have been very, very actively looking for the perpetrators. I mean, one of the things that really caught my eye was a couple of weeks ago, the state of Massachusetts gave out $23 million in federal grant money for Homeland Security projects. And this is sort of routine stuff, right? It's cybersecurity drills for the agencies. There's disaster planning for your local emergency planning department. But In this case, they also specifically gave out 7 grants totaling, I think, $1.2 million to Jewish centers in Massachusetts that were designated, and I quote, they were designated a high risk for terror attack. Which, think about it, right? I mean, these are the only individual religious centers singled out in this particular package of grants. And they were singled out because they were a high risk for terrorist attacks, which is sort of stunning.
Rabbi Stern, have you had to deal with any incidents of anti-Semitism in your own community recently?
I think we as a congregation, thankfully, have not had to directly respond to any kind of anti-Semitic incident on our campus.
And have you had to increase security at your temple, Rabbi? Because we're seeing that happen. There's a synagogue not far from where I live, and I see there's increased security there. Have you had to do the same?
I can certainly tell you that security has become a concern that was never a concern. The very notion that a religious institution would have to think about having a guard at the door, that there would have to be, you know, you need a fob or you need to press a bell in order to be allowed entrance. This to me is anathema. I think the whole notion of a religious institution is that doors are always open, and we have to think really carefully about that and how we do it. So, you know, we have a security system in place, and it breaks my heart that we have to do that.
Rabbi Keith Stern is from Temple Beth Avodah in Newton, Massachusetts, and Paul Singer is the investigations editor at the New England Center for Investigative Reporting and WGBH. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Hey, you, podcast person, Amy Walter here. Host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, I'll take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. Happy listening.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're back with The Takeaway. There's no street quite like Sesame Street. Now in its 50th year, the landmark television show has captured the attention of children everywhere across generations. Beloved characters like Big Bird, Elmo, and Cookie Monster have taught kids their ABCs and 1-2-3s, all while singing about food, rubber duckies, and even garbage. But the show hasn't just been about sunny days. It's also helped kids sweep the clouds away. Sesame Street has a long history of explaining complex and difficult subjects in ways that children can understand. Things like homelessness, death, and incarceration. Now, Sesame Street is taking on addiction. In a new video series, Carly, a bright green Muppet with yellow pigtails, reveals to Elmo and other friends that her mom is in recovery.
My mom needs help learning to take better care of herself, so she talks to people with the same problem.
You see, buddy, everybody there is having the same kind of hard time, so they talk with each other about it.
Oh, well, when Elmo talks about a problem that Elmo's having, it helps Elmo feel better.
Carly's experience is the story of many children in the United States today. According to a 2017 report from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, about 8.7 million children under the age of 17 live with a parent who struggles with substance abuse. Dr. Lauren Caldwell is the director of the Children, Youth, and Families Office with the American Psychological Association, and she joins us now to explain the best way to help children understand addiction. Lauren, thanks for being on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me here, Tanzina.
So why do you think Sesame Street finally decided to take on the issue of addiction?
I think that we've seen it grow as an issue in society over the last couple of years to a level that we better understand the effect it's having on families and on children, and it's more primary in our minds to consider that effect and how do we help children deal with it as well.
We just heard a clip, a short clip from the new character, Carly. When Sesame Street portrays or represents addiction in the new series. How do they do it? And what are you seeing in the videos in terms of language and their approach to dealing with it overall?
Sesame Street has a difficult task of trying to put information, and in this case, very complex information, into a format that children across a couple of different developmental stages can take it in. So there's a big difference developmentally between a two-year-old and a six-year-old, which, you know, comprises most of Sesame Street's audience. So they have approached that by providing the information in simple terms a couple of different times, a couple of different ways to try to reach their whole audience. They break down addiction as a health issue, which is very important, and talk about it as dealing with that feeling and also to stop doing that so that you can be more healthy. Sesame Street has a long history of having Muppets interact with each other or Muppets interacting with an older child or an adult. Questions get asked, and there's some further sort of demonstration of how this might make you feel and how to deal with those feelings. And so because of that established format, Sesame Street is somewhat uniquely situated to do a really good job with this.
In your work, this is the area that you focus on. What works and what doesn't work? And I'm sure there's a range of different things, as you mentioned, when depending on a child's age. But generally speaking, when it helps to helping children understand substance abuse, particularly when it's a caregiver or a family member who's facing it, how do children best understand it?
It's very difficult for them to understand the concept of addiction, but it is good to talk about it in terms of health, which, of course, it is a health issue, to talk with them about, you know, the adult isn't feeling well, the adult is ill and needs to feel better and needs to find ways to feel better, that it's helpful to talk about the emotions associated with that. And Sesame Street does a great job of saying your big feelings. When you have big feelings, you need to talk about those big feelings. And when you have reactions, you need to deal with them, whether it's anger or sadness or fear or whatever else. So it's really helping children get in touch with their emotions that they're experiencing because of what's going on in their world, and then helping them deal with those emotions in ways that can be productive for them, especially the youngest children. As children get older, closer to the 6, 7, they might understand more about that addiction is an illness and that it needs to be treated and that the adult might need that treatment in other settings. And so you really have to just take that developmental approach.
What are the limits of pop culture as a vehicle for these conversations, Lauren? I mean, ultimately, Sesame Street has been, you know, obviously a pioneer in this, in a lot of difficult subjects for kids. But don't children need more than just Sesame Street or more than just pop culture?
Absolutely. But I think Sesame Street has a good window into if they can help make this a little more accepted, if they can get this information out. One, so it can help children who need it, but also so more people are exposed to it. That's one of the benefits of pop culture taking this on. Of course, that's not enough, but as it becomes easier for us to talk about, easier for us to acknowledge, it makes it easier for us to get children what they need, which is some consistent, supportive, nurturing caregiving in their environment. Someone or some ones who they can trust and talk with about their feelings and who can help them as they grow older process what's going on in their family, what it means for them, what their role is in that, you know, not to self-blame, not to feel guilt, those types of things, and how to continue on and find a path to resilience in this process of going through recovery in their family.
What are the long-term effects, Lauren, of children who grow up with parents or caregivers who are dealing with addiction? This doesn't seem to be something that will go away. It just feels like something that will evolve, particularly if it's not treated, if their feelings are not addressed early on.
It's hard to say generally what it's going to be for any individual child. There are a range of circumstances that affect what it means in a child's environment. It can mean trauma and difficulty for themselves in finding a healthy path in their own lives. It can also mean that they develop great resilience. And of course, in a family where the addiction is dealt with, the family member gets help, and the family is well supported, it can mean just a strong, healthy, resilient family and can be a very positive experience for the child to have that recovery in their environment. So it's not always that it's going to be a detriment, but certainly untreated addiction, inconsistency in the context of the family that it creates can be highly problematic for children as they grow up.
And what should people, caregivers or family members who are not addicted, be paying attention to in children's behavior, those children who are dealing with addicted parents? Like, are there signs that say this child needs attention and they should be, paying closer attention to what they're feeling?
It's important if you have a child, especially a young child in a family with addiction, to note, to pay attention to that and try to think about how it's affecting the child. It's easy to get caught up in what the person with the addiction needs, but it's very important to think about what's going on with the child. And that might not be as readily evident. Children may hide their emotions to some extent, but you may see them start to be either more angry or more fearful or more sad. They may have more uncontrollable emotional outbursts. They may isolate themselves more. Also, other children react differently. They may be more attention-seeking. They may need more reassurance and be more clingy or try to engage more. And so it's hard to say what any one child will do. The real thing to look for is this child behaving differently than they have before? Or, are you seeing them not engage in ways that you would expect for the age that they are?
Lauren Caldwell is the director of the Children, Youth, and Families Office with the American Psychological Association. Thanks for joining us, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.